I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Ten years ago, that long stretch of water between the U.S. and Cuba, the Florida Straits, were speckled with thousands of rafts. Desperate men and women trying to make their way to a better life in America. It was a time when Castro told his people they wouldn't be punished for trying to leave. And as many as 50,000 did just that, some on nothing more than inner tubes strapped together. One of the television news crews that rushed to that scene to tell the story of the rafters or the balseros was from the Spanish current affairs program 30 Minutes. Except the work that this team started on that day lasted so much longer, 10 years, in fact. The reporter and filmmaker, Carlos Bosch, chose a number of Cuban rafters, some who made it out and others who didn't, and then he followed them and he filmed them over the course of the next 7 to 8 years. The result of all that work is a feature-length documentary that paints an amazing and nuanced picture of success and failure, of family and of patriotism. As we talk about the film, we want you to join us with your own story of coming to America and what gets lost in the news coverage and public policy debates about new immigrants in this country. How does the America you dreamed of compare with the America you got? My guest is the filmmaker and television reporter, Carlos Bosch. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you very much.
And the music that we're listening to is music that comes from the film Balseros. You had much of it done originally for the film.
Yeah, it's written by Lucrecia. She's a Cuban singer who lives in Barcelona. She's a composer and she also sings and she did the music for the film.
1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. That's the number for you to join my conversation this hour with Carlos. Now, you are still working as a television reporter, or now you're a big famous filmmaker?
No, but I'm involved in the promotion of the film for the last year because we didn't expect it was going to be such a snowball. And, well, for the last year, my television, who's co-producing the film, they allowed me to just do the promotion of the film. But I think that in 1 month, maybe 1 month, I'll be back as a journalist working for television.
Did you think back in 1994 that you would do a story like this?
Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, I remember with the co-director, who's the cameraman of the film, when we were flying back from Havana to Barcelona, it was the day after we filmed the last rafter starting to roar. We were flying and we saw the sea from the plane and we were talking, we were saying, well, this is an incredible story for a fiction film director. We are sure that someone one day, a filmmaker, will make a film out of this. The idea came, I would say, years after.
Did you see any of the rafts as you were flying out of Havana?
No, but we knew because a few hours ago we were in the sea filming them. Obviously they had to be there.
Let me tell me if I get my time right, though, because you film the rafters taking off, and then soon you're back in Havana and you're filming the people who got picked up and taken to Guantanamo Bay. And then that's like 2 years into it. Now another 5 years passes. You go back again. So in some cases, the story that you're telling of these seven different stories that are woven together in the film, it's over an 8 year period of the moment from the time that you met them till you last filmed them.
Yeah, we were there when they were taking the decision, when they're making the decision. I was having my holidays in the Dominican Republic, and it has happened to me many times as a journalist to be having my holidays in the middle of nowhere, and all of a sudden there is a revolution in the corner.
Yeah.
So then I rushed to Havana, and I called my company. I said, well, I'm in Havana. You have to send a cameraman because that's incredible. Well, we did a kind of 30 minutes current affairs story very urgently. We edited it. We went back to Barcelona. And then a few months later, I got permission from my company to go to Guantanamo and see what happened to all of them. Mm. I mean, it's true that at the end of the day, my film ends by being the story of seven people. But at the beginning, it was the story of 30,000 people. I would like to say that these seven people, after the 8 years, they still represent the average of the 30,000 people. And unfortunately, they do represent the average of the immigrants all over the world. But at the beginning, it was just pure journalism.
You were very lucky, though. You were, I know enough about the work that you do to know that you can go to a place like this and get people who aren't very good in a story. But the people that you found were remarkable. The stories that they tell give this unbelievable overall view.
We always say, journalists, when we do stories for television, that you need to be lucky to do a good story. But I think that most of the times we are lucky, especially if you follow, if you are stubborn, if you follow your people, if you don't stop filming, if you don't go to sleep, if you spend maybe the whole night driving just to get one shot in the other corner. And, yeah, we were lucky, but at the same time, I would like to say that, and that's what I always tell the audience, because the audience, when they see the film, they tend to ask, how did you pick your characters? And I say, whoever among you in this audience of 500 people in a cinema, whoever among you who's followed by a camera for 7 years, 8 years, 10 years, during the most, let's say, important period of his life, whoever among you will become a character.
We're going to talk a little bit more about your relationship with those people in a minute, but I'd like to introduce one of them now. His name is Juan Carlos Subiza. He and his girlfriend, Miss Clados, are among the people who were clambering onto these rafts back in 1994. Now, Juan Carlos Subiza lives today in Granby, Connecticut, and I spoke to him just a little bit earlier about what it was like to see himself in the film in Cuba 10 years ago. I asked him if he liked the film.
It's a great film. It's a great film.
What's it like to see yourself 10 years ago in Cuba?
It's amazing. Somebody told me 10 years ago, I'm going to have this kind of life right now in the United States. I don't believe it. So it's unbelievable.
Let's go back to that time, if we can, Juan. You and Miklida, you wanted so much to leave Cuba back in 1994. Yeah. Why did you want to leave then?
Well, because I want to have a better life, like everybody want to leave to Cuba. You know, I want to have a house, I want to have a car, I want to have a job, I can make money and do stuff I can do. I want to be freedom to do whatever I want to do.
But it was a pretty risky thing that you did for you and your girlfriend to get on that raft, wasn't it?
Yes, it's pretty risky, but sometimes in this life you have to take the decision, and that's the decision, leave to Cuba and have a better life.
Can you describe the raft for us, Juan?
About 10 feet longer, about 7 swim tube, you know, drug tubes, and 13 people. Pretty good. Not too bad.
That sounds pretty crowded to me.
Good stuff. No. Cuba's an island, and we live in the ocean, so we know what are we doing.
And all held up by inner tubes, right?
Yeah, by inner tubes, yeah.
Okay. Now, how long were you at sea?
Like 2 days.
And then the U.S. Coast Guard caught you?
Yeah, the U.S. Coast Guard picked it up. We sent to Guantanamo Bay for like a year and 4 months. Yeah.
A year in Guantanamo?
16 months, yeah.
And all that time that you're waiting then in Guantanamo, did you know that you would eventually get to the United States, or did you think maybe they would just send you back to Havana?
Oh, no, definitely we know they're not going to send to Havana. We, United States, USA base in Guantanamo is the United States property, so we know they're not going to send back to Havana. But we don't know what time, and one day we're going to come into the United States. So we have to wait. And the first 10 months or 11 months, we don't know till they decide everybody not have trouble in Cuba or in Guantanamo can come into the United States, and we wait that moment.
There's a part in the film that I thought was really funny. It's when you and Miklada are talking on the phone and then looking at a map and trying to figure out where this place, Connecticut, is.
Yes, I don't know. We never hear nothing. You know, when you live in Cuba, you don't have too much information about the United States. You know, place like Miami or New York, because you see in the movies, stuff like that. But Hartford, Connecticut, I never heard the name in my life. So, but we make it good. This is a nice people here in New England. I like it.
That's Juan Carlos Subiza. He is one of the characters featured in a new documentary film by Carlos Bosch. It's called Balseros, and it tracks 7 different Cubans in their own ferried attempts to leave the island, starting back in 1994. And Carlos is here with me in the studio. We'd like to have you join us with your own thoughts about these desperate efforts to come to this country. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. And Carlos, I wish people could see the faraway look in your eyes when Juan was speaking. I was watching you and thinking, this man now has become more than a character in a documentary film. He's more like a friend to you, I would imagine.
He's really a friend. Yeah, we've been together. This is an incredible adventure for him. I've been just following him, but at the same time, it was my first feature documentary film. But already 1.5 years ago, when we finished the film, we decided that Juan Carlos would be our person to travel to Spain for the premiere. He's been also traveling with us to. We couldn't have him at Sundance because he was working in a garage and he's allowed to leave the garage for 2, 3, 4 days only. But he's been our person for many reasons. I think that he's a very nice guy and he understands 100% what's been his story and the story of all of them. He's not selfish. He's proud about what he did, but he understands the failure of the others. I was listening to him first. It's always a pleasure to listen to him. As a matter of fact, I will see him in a few days because he's coming to Boston for the Human Rights Watch
International Film Festival. Yeah, I hope he stops by here just to say hello.
He'll be here. He will be our surprise for the audience, yeah.
And yet there are some desperate stories as well. His has moments of emotion, but there are women who choose to become prostitutes so they can make money, so they can buy inner tubes, so they can build rafts. This is pretty dramatic stuff.
Well, that's the way it is. I mean, not because, during that period was in order to get the money and build the raft. Unfortunately, not just in Cuba, in many third world countries. And let's not forget that Cuba became a third world country during the early 90s because of the lack of the support from the Soviet Union. So that's why it happened. I mean, some people, very, very few people, but just one newspaper in Miami criticized the film by saying that we didn't portray that exodus as a political one, but an economical one. I do stand that this was an economical exodus. And when Fidel decided to open the coast and allow everybody to leave, 30,000 people left because they were desperate because of economical reasons, probably among them. There were also people who were also desperate because of political reasons. But I keep saying that if Mexico opens the coast, if the Dominican Republic opened the coast, there will be also 30,000 or 40,000. And I'm sure that among them, there will be also one percentage of people who will think that their problems it's because of capitalism. So it's also a political problem. That specific exodus was very much an economical one. There have been others which were more related to politics.
We're hearing in the background just a little bit more of the music from the film Balseros. Carlos Bosque is with me in the studio. It's his feature-length documentary tracking the lives of Cubans making their way from their country to this one. We'd like to have you join us with your own thoughts and experiences of similar. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. We're talking this hour about new documentary film, Balseros. Balseros is Spanish for rafters, the Cuban rafters who by the tens of thousands tried to make their way to the United States back in 1994. This is a film that follows them. And a little bit earlier in the program, we heard from one of them, Juan Carlos Subiza, and he and his girlfriend, Miss Clyda, make their way from Havana to Guantanamo to Miami and eventually to Granby, Connecticut. And in my earlier conversation with Juan, he talked about arriving in Connecticut where the Catholic Church helped him out.
We picked up by the church in Granby, like a 5 different churches. For 10 or 12 years, they helped refugee people. They got an apartment, a work, for the first couple of years, till we decide we're going to take our life by ourselves, you know?
There's another scene in the film that I wanted to hear you talk about, and that is in the when you and Miklada are going to look at cars.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, well, I want this brand new one. And you're saying, hey, we can't afford this brand new one. And it seems like the same sort of conversation that people have all the time.
It's amazing. No, I never got caught in Cuba. I never have a house. Definitely, I don't have nothing in Cuba. But I don't need a real nice car. I just need something to go to work because, you know, we're coming here with our English is not too good and it's hard to find a good job. We don't make that kind of money, but definitely we don't buy that car.
And then sometime after that, you and Miklada break up. Is that right?
Yes. We break like a 2 years after we live here. We got some problem and she decides to move to Phoenix, Arizona, yeah?
And you will probably already know, but I see in the film, and you would see in the film, that she's ended up with a pretty unhappy life, getting involved with drugs. What's it like for you to see how that happened to her?
It's hard, because I lived with Miss Claya for 5 years, 3 years in Cuba and 2 years here. She want to live a different life what I want to live, you know what I mean? When I come into here, I want to help myself, plus I want to help my family in Cuba. I want to take care of my family. I want to take care of my brother, my sister. And that's what I have in my heart when they leave the Cuba. So, and she should make that choice. She got to pay for that, you know. I don't want to live that kind of life. I want to work. I want to make money. I want to do my life the way I like it. Between me and Miss Claya, that we have different idea. It's hard for her now, but I hope so. She's doing good next time.
You send a lot of money home to Cuba, don't you?
Well, I think, like, my mom can have a better life, you know, like, she can have a food, she can have a clothes. I buy stuff for her in Cuba because that's my mother. I gotta love my mom, you know?
What I was wondering when I watched that, though, is you say you're happy to be in the United States. Are you happy to be in the United States because here you can make the money and help your mom? Or are you happy to be in the United States because you're happy here?
Well, you know, it's nice I can have a job. I can help make money and help my family in Cuba. But it's nice I have a freedom to, you know, I can decide whatever I wanted. See, I want to live here, or I want to move to south or to west. I decide, yeah, I move. See, I want to have a car, I have it. It's a life, freedom life, you know what I mean? And that's more important for me. I do it whatever I want to do.
What's the work that you're doing, Juan?
I work in the tire place. I sell tires.
Wait a minute, you left Cuba on a tire?
Yeah, I did work in the tire place. It's amazing. Huh?
Do you tell people? Do you say now, hey, I left Cuba on a tire, I'm a Balseros?
Oh, yeah, they know. They ask me for my history, and a lot of people, I got the film at home, and they watch the film, and it's amazing, and they ask me a lot of questions, and how's it Cuba, how will you live, how big is the tube, and so I work in the same place here. I show the way. It's nice.
You have a beautiful red convertible, too.
Yes.
I saw that in the film. And I gather that you have a new wife. Is she in Cuba? Is she with you in Granby, Connecticut?
No, she's still in Cuba. I'm waiting for the paperwork, and she's going to come in, I hope, pretty soon.
And you'll then have a family in Connecticut?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Like, I make an American dream, you know. We're going to make life pretty good here. I hope so.
And Juan, do you think that your children will ever go back to Cuba?
Of course, they're going to go back to Cuba, and they're going to speak Spanish, too.
So they will be, you'll make sure that they keep that Cuban heritage, right?
Oh, of course, yes, yes.
I guess my last question, Juan, is that why it's good for you to be in America? Because you can live in Granby, Connecticut, and you can still be a Cuban-American with American citizenship?
It's hard sometimes, but it's not too many choices, you know what I mean? I got a much better life than what I got in Cuba before. Here I live for American people. Nobody speaks Spanish here, but it's nice. I like it. I think it make a sense, you know.
Juan, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. You're very good at describing how things work.
Okay, thank you.
Juan Carlos Sobeza is one of the characters in a new feature documentary film called Balseros. The director of that film, Carlos Bosque, is here with me in the studio. I was just thinking, listening to the last, how he began his last answer. He said, it's hard sometimes. He's a very, very straightforward, honest man like that.
I think that for every immigrant, it's hard. So I don't think that the film is very much about if the American dream exists or doesn't exist. I would say if the dream of making it in the first world exists or doesn't exist. And I would say that maybe it exists, but it's a very high price. Whoever who leaves his country behind is a loser. I'm glad to listen to Juan Carlos being that optimistic. I have to say that if Juan Carlos was my only character, I wouldn't have done the film. But at the same time, I would say that if his wife was the only character of the film, I wouldn't have a film, neither. Maybe a fiction film, both of them. I think that since I'm a journalist, I have to give the idea of the average of them. Having said that, I would like to say that Miss Clyda stopped selling drugs before we finished the editing of the film. I'm very glad. And
she's clean now?
Yeah, yeah. We are in touch, and I listen to her, and I think she's doing better. She's studying now to become a nurse. You never know with someone who took a wrong step. You never know what will happen to her, but we are in touch with her. Juan Carlos is in touch with her. He's fantastic, although he was somehow morally punished because of the divorce, etc. He's such a good guy that he really wants to help the others. It's very interesting when I show the film to the seven characters that they all love each other, although they don't know each other. And they always ask me about the other. And it's very good. As a matter of fact, if we get the nomination for the Oscar, that it's going to be difficult, but on the 27th we will know it.
Right.
We have promised all of them to make a kind of reunion.
That would be a scene.
Because they want to know each other.
Yeah, yeah. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join us. Let's go to Boston, Massachusetts, and Tony is joining us. Tony, thank you for calling.
You're welcome. Yes. Yes. I'm a little nervous. I'm not familiar with phone calls and radios. But
that's okay. Just pretend it's you and me talking. What are you thinking when you listen to this film?
I was a fisherman once, but basically I was forced to become a fisherman when I was 11 years old. I fished those waters out there, and one of the most dangerous waters in the Caribbean, at the Gulf of Mexico, the stretch of Florida, and Paso Lo Viento between IT and Oriente. And it's when I see people throwing themselves and tire tubes and trying to cross those 90 miles those stretch of the stretch of Florida there with the currents the way they are and the sharks and the way they it's desperate I guess desperate times call for desperate measures anyways.
Did you do this, Tony? Did you also leave Cuba? Did you cross that water yourself?
I was a fisherman. I was an instructor on a school fishing boat in the late 60s, and we escaped from basically we hijacked the boat what we were working on, and we landed in Mexico, Cozumel, the island of Cozumel in Mexico. We crossed right through Mexico into Laredo, and I ended up in Florida. I was in Miami, living there for about 3 months only.
Tony, if you can, just stay with me for a minute. I want to turn to Carlos Bosque here because I found one of the most powerful moments in the film was when you are out on the sea and you're filming empty rafts.
Yeah, yeah, it happened to us. We were trying to follow our characters because we were not allowed to. We had a boat. We rented a boat with a captain, but it belonged to the estate, and we were just allowed to start sailing with the early days, with the early lights of the day, but go back to the harbor before dawn.
Right.
So we started filming our characters, but we had to go back. So the next day, we restarted again trying to find them, and by trying to find them, we found all the rafters, but very often we found empty rafts.
Tony, does that remind you of your own experience?
Well, like I say, I had a 70-foot fishing boat that, compared with a raft, that's a pleasure boat.
No, I understand. I just meant talking about how dangerous it is.
Oh, as a fisherman, the fisher's waters, I know how dangerous. I think these people, what they're doing, see, they're so desperate, they don't know what they're doing. Those waters are so dangerous in there. In 1980, I went back to Mariel to get my family out of Cuba. And as we're going into Cuba, we seen life jackets. There was little boats going in from Key West to Cuba. They would disappear. Families would never, people that went from here to Cuba were never found, you know. So it's dangerous water. It took us to go to Cuba 22 hours to come back only 11 hours. That's because of currents. That's one of the reasons why they get, you know, they get into the Gulf Stream and come into the islands in Florida. But it's dangerous waters, and, you know, it's just sad to see what's happening there. I think if they lift embargo, this stuff disappears.
Tony, I want to thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
Call anytime.
Thanks a lot.
1-800-423-8255 is that number. Now, you know what I found?
It was a nice sentence, the last one, about the embargo.
There's politics in this. There's lots of politics in this. The natural part of this story, the expected part of this story, is that when people survive that dangerous water or survive the trip to America, that you then put a point down and you say, see, happy ending. You get to America, happy ending. But you don't do that with your characters.
Well, that's what I did. As a matter of fact, as I told you before, I made the decision of doing a feature documentary film 2 years ago.
Yeah.
So from 1994 to 1996, I've been following them just for television. So I produced two different stories. The first one was a very urgently edited current affairs story.
Right.
But the second one was already 2 years later. We finished filming them, and we produced a 52 minutes documentary for television when they were already in the United States. And I would say that it works for television, because in television you don't have to complete the circle, but you have a story. Many stories that we do for televisions, like the beginning of a revolution or beginning of a war, mm-hmm. You don't need the end. It is a story to be continued. But it somehow it was, okay, this was the end. These people tried to make it to the United States. They've been stopped in Guantanamo for a year and a few months. But then they are already in the States starting a new life. We thought this was the end. I don't want to say if it was a happy end or not a happy end, but this was the end. And it was distributed to many televisions all over the world. It was 5 years later, since I've been in touch with some of them during these 5 years, that one day I thought, well, maybe it's time to go back and see what happened to them. Now, I would say, now the circle is completed. Well, or kind of an air spiral, because it's never completed. It starts and starts
keeps
and
going,
starts again.
It keeps going, yeah.
But no, it's not that I decided, okay, I don't want to stop filming now and let's see what happened to them. It's just that, okay, first part was produced for television, and my film now, it's I went back to those 100 hours that I filmed between 94 and 96, and then I went back to see what happened to them, and I got quite shocked, for the good and for the bad. Yeah.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go back to the phones to Columbia, South Carolina. Ian's joining us now. Ian, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my phone call. I just wanted to make a few comments. In my personal situation, I was a member of the United States Coast Guard, and I was aboard a cutter that ran through the Straits of Florida and dealt with migrant interdiction, and not only Cubans, but also Haitians as well. And I believe what Tony is exactly right. I agree with lifting the Cuban embargo. I think that would really help everyone. I think it's a win-win situation for everyone.
Why would it be a win-win then, Ian?
I for several reasons. For a couple reasons, I don't want to put my opinions with the United States Coast Guard or anything like that, but my personal opinion is that it gives us, the United States, a better way of safely getting people into this country. This country has always had open arms to immigrants, and I find this current administration's policies to be opposite of those, contrary to those beliefs.
They are pretty harsh. And I just want to—I've got time to ask you, if you don't mind, to tell me what you saw when you were out on the water that leads you to this belief. Were you also seeing empty rafts? What did you see out there?
I myself have seen pieces of rafts. We've gone out and search and rescue. We get intel that, you know, there's a sighting of a raft, and we get out there, and sometimes there is a raft, and, you know, that there's people in the water holding on to the raft. You know, it's so overcrowded that, you know, people can't even completely stay on the raft. And we've had to pick them up and get them off that raft for their own safety. You know, I've seen people put, you know, pallets out in the water, you know, and put them on inner tubes, and put little five horsepower Johnson motors on the end of them, and, you know, tied them with rope to get them to try and get there. It's just a horrible situation. People should not have to do this. There's too much wealth in this country to ignore some people who are less than 20 miles away. I just 80 miles away, I guess. I just really think that there's too strong a connection between the Cuban population that's in this country and the people of Cuba to keep this embargo.
Ian, I want to thank you for your call. Certainly that connection between the people of Cuba and the people who have come to this country is something that is very well shown in the documentary film Balseros. I have with me in the studio Carlos Bosque. He is the director of that film. His other job is working as a television reporter, which is what got him involved with this in the first place. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join our conversation this hour as we talk about the film.
Rosales que al florecer mi alegría y belleza inundaron mi ser.
Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. With me in the studio, Carlos Bosque, director of the documentary film Balseros, which tells the story of Cuban rafters, people trying to get on rafts to get from Cuba to the United States back in 1994. His film work follows them throughout the past 10 years and weaves the stories of seven of them together. It's quite remarkable to watch. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join that conversation. Before we go back to the calls, Carlos, I want you to explain one of the storytelling devices you use here. I think it's fascinating to watch. It's because you're a journalist and a filmmaker that you get to go to Cuba and to Miami and back to Cuba. And you get to carry with you video cassettes. And so the people who have been left behind, or the people who have left family behind, you get to show them images of what's going on, which they would not get any other way. And it becomes a way that you tell the story as well.
Well, that's very much a Cuban way of being in touch among them. Of course, between Cubans here and Cubans there is a lot of communication. And one of the ways of communicating is, since there is always one relative traveling back to Cuba, he's always carrying tapes with all the family. So what we did, it's part of the normal procedure among Cubans. Of course, the first time that it happened and it came to our ideas to use it as a footage for our film or for the documentary was during the period that they were stopped in Guantanamo. The relatives in Cuba, they had no idea about what happened to the relatives. There was a very bad communication between the Cuban and the American administrations, as usual, especially during that period. So many people, many relatives back in Cuba, they had no idea about what happened to the relatives, if they were among those that the rumors said they were in Guantanamo, in the naval base on Guantanamo. So can you imagine for us being, for instance, in Guantanamo, let's say one Monday, filming Oscar, filming Miss Clyda, filming Juan Carlos, and the next day or 2 days after being in Havana and telling their relatives, we've been with your son, we've been with your father. And how he is. Well, look, he is like this. That's the way he was 2 days ago. That's perfect. And the very first moment that we understood that it was very powerful, much more powerful than any other tools used by a journalist, it was when we were filming Miriam, who's the mother, who was already in Miami. She was the first group to be allowed to go from Guantanamo to the United States because she was sick. Then we were showing to her daughter, because she had left her daughter back in Batabano, Cuba. And the daughter was 1 year old, 2 years old. I don't know how old she was. She was in the age of start walking. Since I don't have children, I don't know which age
you're right,
it is.
Somewhere between one and two, yeah.
So, and then the mother was seeing the images that we filmed a few days before, and the daughter was walking in the street, and all of a sudden she fell down. The reaction of the mother seeing those images on the screen was to try to catch the TV set. I remember looking at the cameraman, and the cameraman looking at me saying, yes, I got it, and how incredible it was. First, I'm not an immigrant. Second, I don't have children. So for me, it was a very, very new experience. What I would say, and that's something I've been talking to some fiction filmmakers. First, it's very difficult for a fiction filmmaker to imagine that shot. Second, if one fiction filmmaker decides to invent and put this shot in a fiction film, probably the producers will tell him, come on, you are exaggerated. It doesn't happen. That's why I keep thinking that reality is much more incredible than fiction. That shot, for me, means a lot. As a matter of fact, it's probably my favorite shot in the film.
A good friend of mine watched the film, saw that shot, and burst into tears.
Yeah.
I think he does.
Yeah.
On people. 1-800-423-8255. Back to the phones. To Louisville, Kentucky now, and Alicia is calling in. Alicia, thanks for calling.
Thank you. Okay, I did not see the film, but in listening to your broadcast, it reminded me of an experience I had with a Cuban immigrant who at the time was my boyfriend, and something he said to me that always stuck with me. When I met him, he had only been in the country less than a year. I'm an ESL teacher, and that's how I met him. And he came here for economic reasons. He was in his mid-20s, and he had grown up in communism, and he didn't know anything else and was not political. But he said to me once, I have more here than I ever had in my own country. And this is true because he had that kind of consumer fever where he went out and bought the big TVs and the cell phone and everything. Mm-hmm. And he said, I have more here, but I feel poorer here than I ever felt in my country. And that just stayed with me. And he actually sent me to Cuba. He couldn't afford to go back. He couldn't afford to take the time off. And he didn't have the vacation anyway. And he sent me back to visit his family, and he had not been back yet. And it was just a mind-blowing experience, and I really want to see the movie now. That's all I wanted to share with you, really.
Well, I'm glad that this person arose this question, because always when we talk about Cubans coming to the United States, it seems like this is, okay, a political story. And, well, I wouldn't like the people to translate my film like, okay, how good the first world is compared to the third world, especially a communist third world. I would say that, in my film, I don't want to say which percentage of my characters made it or which percentage didn't make it. It's up to the audience to decide. But obviously, at the end of the film, you get to conclusions like this one. I mean, probably it was difficult over there, but how difficult it is here. I would like to add something, especially now, especially nowadays, especially probably under this administration. And some people have a lot of things when they come here, but when you look at their eyes in the film, well, it's hard to tell if they are happier or sadder than before. As a matter of fact, when you decide to to leave your country behind and go to another country, whatever it is, United States or Spain, because if my film somehow portrays the United States, but it helps also to portray the Spain that the Africans know when they get to Spain trying to find a job. Well, for whoever who leaves his country behind without really willing, because I'm sure that Juan Carlos, excuse me, would prefer to be now
being
in Cuba.
I'm sure.
I know him. So for whoever who makes this decision, this is like riding a very wild horse, and the horse will follow a path that probably has nothing to do with your ideas about the future when you were a child. Juan Carlos said before during the interview that, wow, look at me, what am I doing here? I mean, he's glad, of course, but I'm here in Granby, new friends. Well, this is probably the end of the path that was taken by the wild horse. I would say that in his case, he was lucky. Second, he was strong enough.
Yeah.
For some other people, they were not strong, but more than that, they were not lucky. It could depend on just the person who opens the file, and instead of taking you to Granby, they take you to Nebraska, they take you to whatever place that probably has nothing to do with your own character. So again, it's a wild horse, and just maybe 10% of your future will depend on you.
You mentioned Nebraska. There's another character in the film, Rafael Cano, who, and I go back to what I was saying earlier about happy endings, because he gets to Miami, there's a room waiting for him, a relative, there's a big hug, and you go, ah, everything's going to be okay for Rafael. I mean, this is after he gets shoved off a raft that he has a place on, because the crooks say, no, we want this spot. So we leave him then. And I think the story of Rafael is over. And then you take us back. We're in Nebraska. And he's reflecting back on something that we don't know. He says, well, Miami wasn't so good. There was drugs. It was rough. It was this. And here's this Cuban saying, I'm so happy to be in the American prairie where it's quiet and it's peaceful. And I think, oh, now it's over. And then at the very end of the film, and I won't go any further because it's I know one of the strong narrative points in the film, he comes back again. And that's part of, I think, where your eyes sparkle in what you can do with something when you spend so much time on it. Is that true?
Yeah, but there is a logical. If you see, for instance, in the case of Rafael, you understand at the very end why he ended up the way he ended up. Somehow, I would say somehow. I mean, it's a kind of logical thing. It's like the shot with the conversation between Juan Carlos and Miss Clyde buying the car.
Yeah,
we didn't use it 6 years ago for television, believe it or not. Because it was taken to nothing. It's when 6 years after we found out the way both of them reacted in front of the new life in the United States that shot made sense. With Rafael, it's the same. If you see the way he was in Havana, kind of nice guy, very, you know, not really strong, accepting whatever decision, being pushed out from the first raft, losing the money and everything, trying to get a second raft, then you understand that this person is not strong enough to face the new life.
1-800-423-8255. To Lake Placid, New York now. Ernie's joining us. Ernie, thanks for calling.
Good morning to you, gentlemen. Yes, from September 95 to February 96, I was at the United States Army, and we were stationed at Guantanamo Bay, and we ran Camp Echo of the holding camps, if you will, and we were there until the last Balsero went to the United States, and we tore down the camps and what have you. I am looking greatly forward to seeing the film and seeing some of the happy endings. It is nice to know that definitely people did go to the United States, and there are happy endings, and it was quite an eye-opening experience in dealing with the Balseros 4 or 5 months, wonderful people, and what amazed me the most was their desire to come to the United States and be, you know, make a definite impact on society in the United States and contribute to society.
Those of us who are privileged enough to be born in a country like the United States, it's almost like you or me, we have to have an experience like meeting people in Guantanamo Bay to understand just how privileged we are.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I left Guantanamo Bay, went back to Alaska, and you know, I told Eric about the United States and from a new perspective, you know, and it was eye-opening, and it was wonderful, and it was probably one of the most enriching experiences that I've had, you know, so.
Ernie, I want to thank you for your call, because I'm sure that Carlos Bosque would say that the exercise in meeting all these people was for you, someone who is in the tumble of daily journalism or weekly journalism, to have the chance to meet these people and get to know them must have been a tremendous life-changing experience for you.
Yeah, especially following them for those many years, because journalists usually we don't follow the stories. Not because we don't want, just because that's the way it is in our job. You just meet people and you meet the story, which is happening today, and you will forget about them. You will forget about the story. But having the chance to follow them for those many years, now I know. Now I can say that I know a little bit about what does it mean to become an immigrant. Yeah.
And what surprised you when you look back at the experience? What's the one thing that surprised you that you learned?
Well, again, when I think about Rafael, the character you mentioned before, who's now, well, it's better not to say, because for the people too, who I hope will go to see the film next Monday. So when I think about him in the past, or when I think about Médicis, when I think about those that I met in Cuba, I cannot be happy. I'm sorry, I cannot be happy when I see them now. They made it or they didn't make it, but I cannot be happy. The same way I cannot be happy seeing an immigrant in Spain, and I have a few friends, of course, who are immigrants, yeah, from Senegal, from Morocco. Maybe they made it in Spain, maybe they didn't make it in Spain, but I cannot be happy for them because I've seen them when they were at home with their relatives, with their music, with their food, and this is not what I wish for myself.
Carlos, I want to thank you so much for coming in to be with me this hour.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Carlos Bosque, director of the new documentary film Balseros. We are at www.theconnection.org, and there's a link to more information about the film Balseros on the website. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Para
en la puerta.